Yes, I was more suited, I think, to jobbing because I wouldn't be able to bring business into a broking firm. I didn't come from the right background, and
Do you have any particular memories of life as a Blue Button? Any experiences stand out?
it was fun. I quite enjoyed it. It was hard work, but you did enjoy it. It was the working on the floor of the old stock exchange. There was a wooden floor which used to sort of resonate. You could feel that the market was busy or quiet, or whether the market was going up or down even. There was this sort of feeling in your water or in your bones of what was going on, how busy things were, and you felt part of it. Although you're working for different firms, you soon established relationships, friendships with other people, and it was a great place to work in those days. It really was.
Where had you been living?
I was still living at home with my parents in Enfield, about 10 miles north of the city, and commuting by train every day.
Now, in 1967, you became a dealer.
Yes.
What did that involve?
That involved, again, I got it perhaps a bit earlier than I was expecting it, but I was the firm told me they wished me to become a dealer. I believe I had to go before a small committee of people of the stock exchange to answer one or two questions, which they sort of fairly elementary ones that they sort of tested your knowledge of certain facts or rules and regulations of the stock exchange on for admission to becoming a dealer.
Did you have any particular feelings about becoming a dealer? Did you feel you were ready for it, or was it a frightening
It was a little
prospect?
bit, I was nervous or apprehensive to begin with, but I soon settled down and became used to it.
Were you still working on Mr. Capper's book? That's aircraft.
On the aircraft book, yes, I was initially. And then I moved over to work with Mr. Ling King and his team, which was a mixed bag of industrial and engineering shares.
About when was that?
This would perhaps have been in 1968. I think this was to help bolster the team because I think it was at the time then Mr. King was going to go on around the world trip. This was a thing that the senior partners seemed to do coming up towards their retirement. They would take sort of 3 months, perhaps a bit more off, and go and spend a bit of money doing something like this. Mr. King, I know, went on a around the world cruise.
And so that left you a man short, did it?
Well, it left his booker manager. Peter Ramsey was his number two. And John Brown was his, if you like, number three, and I became part of the team.
And how did it work as a unit? You stood close
Well,
to each other and.
yes, but I suppose in a way you had to establish yourself as a junior dealer because the brokers obviously would come up to the more senior dealers because they'd obviously want to deal with the engine driver, not the oil rag. But obviously, you had established friendships, as I said, with brokers, Blue Buttons, over the years. And as they became dealers themselves, being younger chaps, they would naturally come to you if you'd got to know them. And that's how it went on. You would develop your own friendships and working relationships.
Were you given your own separate book? Were you dealing in your.
Not initially, no. I was just working on the book. So no, initially you certainly didn't have your own book and you weren't responsible for your own P&L.
And would you be referring back to the more senior members?
Yes, they would be, because you were standing in a crowd anyway, they would be seeing what was happening and you certainly would not take undue risks. You would be referring back and gradually over a period of time. If they thought you were doing okay, they would obviously leave you to get on with it and trust you perhaps while they were out at lunch on your own or whatever. Mm.
Did you have any particular disasters that you associate with this time as a young dealer?
Perhaps not, because I can't seem to recall any particular disasters, no.
Did anyone try and take advantage of you because you were new, or by the same
time? Yes. The stock exchange was very strong on etiquette. And although there was a general rule book of the stock exchange, which was inches thick, it did not really have any dealing rules as such. The dealing etiquette as such had built up over the years and was unwritten. It becomes a bit technical here, but one of the practices was that if a broker had asked you to come inside, which was to make a narrower price than you had originally quoted, if he'd asked you for a way, as it was known, then he would have to deal with you. On one particular occasion, I recall a rather senior gentleman having asked me the way. I then opened my way, which didn't suit him, and he tried to walk away to go and deal or improve with another firm, which he was not supposed to do. I stopped him by saying, "Well, excuse me, sir, would you mind holding on a minute?" Called in a more senior person on the book, and having explained the situation, he then obviously had to deal with us. Otherwise, he would lose a bit of reputation and standing in the stock exchange. Yes, he was obviously trying to take advantage of me.
Did you find generally that you were in a sort of antagonistic position with brokers, that you had to have your wits about you? Or would they generally be a lot more friendly in the way they did business?
You had to have your wits about you. You had to be on your toes all the time, because it was the sort of job... If you didn't have your eye on the ball, so to speak, they would take advantage of you. If you were a bit slow in changing your price or realising what was going on, I mean, you've got to realise that they're keen to deal, A, to get their commission, and B, to do well for their clients. And you are keen to deal to make money for your firm and not to lose it. So you've got to make sure that if you're selling shares, you can buy them back for a profit or vice versa, which you could only do if you adjusted your prices accordingly.
Do you stay on that particular book for most of your jobbing career now?
No. I moved around from book to book over the years. Various reorganisations took place as we became more of a larger firm. Under the auspices of Mr. Kappa, we seemed to expand and deal in more sectors. We acquired one or two smaller firms over the years. One was called Philpott Dupe. We acquired some dealers from a firm called Anchortel, which gave us an entry into the shipping market. And we, as we gradually expanded, obviously teams were set up to cater for these different books, and the electrical market was something we expanded into, and I became a dealer on the second line electrical book at one stage.
Was that for a long time?
That was for a few years, yes. I can't be precise on dates. But I did seem to evolve into more of what was known as a second line dealer. I was better at dealing in second line stocks rather than what we call the leaders. This was perhaps because I could exploit the situations or the prices better on second line stocks.
Was the type of market for second line stocks very different than for the leaders?
It was, perhaps not so much as it has become in later years. Prices were perhaps wider in second line stocks, and there may have been less jobbers dealing in them, and so you needed to really know the stocks and to know the brokers. It's difficult to describe, but it was more specialist.
When you say you needed to know the stocks, did you actually do a little bit of background research on the firms?
Yes. Our company did not have a research department such as the Wedderlickers and the Aykroyds and the Pynchons of this world. So if you wanted to know about the company, you had to, yes, gin up yourself, either through talking to brokers and other dealers, reading up about them, looking at what we used to call the Moody's cards, which became the Extel cards. Yes, it was down to you.
Mm. And by the same token, did brokers use you as a source of
info? Oh yes, very much so. Mm. Brokers are always what seem to be the pattern. Obviously, a client, normally obviously a private client, would ask his broker, well, what do you think of so-and-so company? Should I invest in Plessy, for instance? And if the broker wasn't too sure or didn't really know what the current feeling, everyone knew that what Plessy did, they made telephones or whatever it might have been, but whether it was right to buy them at that present time, they would always come and ask the jobbers. And the funny thing about that, of course, was that it's a bit like being a car salesman. If the chap came along and said, well, what do you think of Plessy shares, and you happen to be a large bull, although you gave a sort of factual account about, well, they had some good results last month, or they're expecting some good results next month, or whatever you would know factually about them, if you were a bull of them, obviously you would try to sell them, you would talk him into buying them, whereas if you perhaps were a bear of them, and it didn't suit your book to sell them, you would try and put him off. Mm-hmm. The same as I say, if you go along to a showroom and you want to buy a certain type of car, but they haven't got any to sell, mm-hmm. they'll obviously try and sell you something else, or try and tell you you don't really want to buy that one anyway. Mm-hmm. So they were asking us an opinion on a company where we obviously had a vested interest as to how we worded that or how we put it. Mm-hmm. So I think it was the skill of giving them some facts and dressing it up with a bit of fiction.
Did you ever feel you were dealing with brokers who you felt knew more about the share or the company than you did?
Oh yes, quite often, very much so. Obviously, what was known as the shop brokers, they obviously had an inside track because not the dealers necessarily themselves, but various people within their firms would be in day-to-day or whatever it might be, contact with those companies. In those days, of course, insider trading or the laws as such didn't exist. So company directors may well be divulging various information to brokers which was not in the public domain, as a result of which a broker may well tell his clients, look, you know, we must buy these shares. They will come along and be buying them from you, and you will be unaware that the following week something would be announced, a major order or whatever, and the price would react accordingly and go up. So in other words, if you would get to know the people who would do this, therefore if someone dealt with you and bought the shares, you would go out of your way to go and replace that position.
What was the attitude in the stock exchange to what we would now call insider trading? Did people simply accept it as a fact of life and
I think so.
Live with it?
It was not perhaps on such a larger scale as it is these days. I mean, volumes in those days were a lot smaller. People were dealing in smaller amounts. Yes, I think it was a fact of life. It happened. It was not perhaps a blatant. Yeah.
Did you have cases of jobbers forming too close relations with brokers and taking advantage of that kind of information?
I don't think, you mean jobbers forming relationships with brokers to take advantage of that? Yes. But you didn't think of it as something illegal. Well, it wasn't illegal. You weren't doing anything wrong. I mean, if a broker said, look, I'm keen to buy these shares, I've got clients who are keen to buy them, can you supply them? If he had initially bought stock from you and he was therefore morally or ethically tied to you, he would leave you an order. Mm-hmm. Yes, you'd go out to replace that stock and you would pass that stock on, and you would in the process try and perhaps adjust your book position from being a bear to him initially to being a bull and keeping a bull, although you know what you're buying you're passing on to him. So yes, you might well form an alliance with a broker in that respect, but it may be for something quite innocent. You know, they're just building up a position for some particular reason. They want a holding. You wouldn't know. You wouldn't necessarily be told. You were just with the single capacity. There was no need, and you know, sometimes the less you knew, the better.
Mm. Did you ever have cases of people taking personal advantage? I suppose that's what I'm getting at. That you know, a dealer, or you know, not necessarily even a partner, getting word of something through a broker, and taking advantage of that for his own gain.
Yes, I mean, this only becomes evident when someone's bought shares from you, and you know, they subsequently move quite sharply. But you'd obviously, as time went on, get to know who were the sharp characters and who to look out for. And the beauty of the system as it operated then, of course, was when they asked you a price and size in the first place, you could make what you like and say what you like. You would make a defensive price, an uncommercial price, or a price that was restricted in size, which virtually told the character, well, sorry, I don't really want to see your business.
Well, let's sort of resume the story of your career at this point. You got married in 1969.
Yes.
How did you meet your wife?
My wife is Swiss. She was living over here and working as an au pair girl in Enfield, where I met her. And yes, we got married over in Switzerland in 69. And
what did you want? Again, I suppose what we're interested in knowing is, had you met her through the course of work or?
No, I met her locally, socially. Mm-hmm. Nothing to do with the stock exchange at all.
Mm-hmm. And as far as the stock exchange is concerned, in 1970 you became a member.
Yes.
And what did that involve? Were you encouraged to become a member by the firm?
Yes. You were asked, you were told, look, we'd like you to become a member, because if you were a member, you certainly had a lot more standing on the floor of the stock exchange from the firm's point of view. Apart from you as an individual, you had more clout in doing business, if you like. The snag was, to become a member, it was quite an expensive operation in those days. You had to buy your own membership, or you had to pay for your own membership. It cost me something over £2,000. I can't recall exactly, but I think it was 1,000 guineas entrance fee, and the nomination as such, the share I had to buy, cost me again, I think, about £1,200 or so, which all came out of my own pocket.
And did it have any consequences for your role in the firm, or did you continue jobbing?
Yes, both within, but more importantly, I think, outside the firm, because you wore a different colour badge. You wore a silver badge as opposed to the silver badge with the black edge. You had a plain silver badge, as it was before they had coloured badges. And you certainly had a lot more standing with brokers, which would give them more of a comfort factor, I think, in dealing with you. Because if you were standing there as a member representing Bisgood Bishop, then if Bisgood Bishop had faith in you, they must also have that commensurate more of faith in dealing with you.
Around this time, late 60s, early 70s, the old stock exchange building was being demolished and the new one being put up. Does that figure in your memories in any way? Did it make any difference to trading, or make any difference to the atmosphere of the stock exchange?
Very much so. Perhaps I'm a bit old-fashioned here, but I prefer the old floor of the stock exchange. I quite liked it. I think it was about 66 that they put a wall up, in the brick wall in the middle of the stock exchange floor, squashed us all into one half, with the addition of one or two office buildings that were adjacent, while they knocked down the other half and built the tower, the 26-storey tower or whatever it is. Then we moved from the old floor of the stock exchange into what was known as the temporary market, which was on two different levels in the tower, whilst they subsequently knocked down the other half and built the new floor, and then we moved back on. But the old floor of the stock exchange, with its wooden floor, produced a sort of sound, and you could tell by the hum, the noise, what was happening in the market, how busy, how quiet, even if the market was going up or down. Whereas the new floor was sort of lino or whatever, and you just couldn't tell. Mm. A lot of the character went, I'm afraid, with the old stock exchange.
Mm. In what ways?
I don't know. I think, obviously, the jobbing firms had always stood in their traditional places on the floor, and the brokers had their boxes all around in different buildings, and there were Shorter's Court, Capel Court, various names that obviously had been there for 100 years or so, and it was part of history. It was just changed completely.
Did the actual way you did business change in any way? The way you dealt with each other, or did that?
Well, they installed a lot more, obviously more modern communications. We had a lot more telephones on the floor of the new stock exchange. We had one telephone, I recall, when I first went on the floor of the stock exchange in our firm, which was just a general link to the office, which was used very infrequently. On the new floor, virtually every pitch, and I don't know how many pitches, we might have had anything between 6 or 10 different books at that stage, all had their own telephone. Obviously, there was more modern means of relaying company results on the floor of the stock exchange now. We had these pitches were called hexagons, for obvious reason. But no, the business of dealing was still the same, of course. We were still, the jobbers had their pitches, the brokers had their. The brokers walked around. The other thing that was coming in about this time was the admission of women to becoming members, mm. and or becoming, you know, working on the floor of the stock exchange, the odd blue button, the odd dealer and the odd member, women member, mm. which had been heavily resisted.
Mm. Was that jobbing firms as well as broking firms?
It was, although it took longer, I believe, for the for females to get a toehold or a foothold in jobbers than it did in brokers.
Mm. Why was that?
I think it's a bit like, it was a tougher life, I think. Very difficult for a female to become a dealer, a jobber. I think broking was perhaps more suitable to them.
Mm. Did any women become dealers?
Yes, this did take time. And. The reason they became members, the only reason they became members on the stock exchange was because in about 1972 or 73, the various stock exchanges of the United Kingdom were amalgamated to become the Federation of UK Stock Exchanges, and the country firms had voted for membership. London had voted against women members, but upon a federation it was sort of forced upon us through the back door.
Did the presence of women on the floor of the house affect the atmosphere in any way?
I think it did a little bit. I do recall one broking member who did say the day that they allow women on the floor of the stock exchange, he would resign and retire, and he did. He stayed true to his word, and he retired early, never to walk the floor of the stock exchange again. But you had people who would go out of their way to be perhaps rude, abrupt, impolite, because they disagreed with the concept of women on the floor, and you would have others, perhaps the majority, who would moderate their tongue and their language, because when things got tough on the floor, perhaps the language did get a bit, the air did get a bit blue at times. But of course, the stock exchange floor was also a physical place. And if there had been a major company result, the jobber's pitch was going to get crowded with brokers anxious to hear the price and perhaps deal. And there was no way that you were going to make niceties, and I was going to say, well, let the lady go first or whatever. But give them their due. They didn't expect this. They wanted to give as good as they got, and they accepted this, I think. They didn't come in with any illusions.
Mm. Mm.
And I must have met some of the girl dealers or the female dealers. They were okay. They and over a period of time, obviously, they became accepted and part of it.
Yeah. Now, you became a member dealer in 1970.
Yes.
What was the next stage on the progression?
Well, obviously, it meant I had increased standing within the firm and on the stock exchange. I had more people perhaps working under me. I was becoming more senior now. Obviously, running my own book as opposed to being a number two, so to speak.
Yes. Can you explain a little bit more about when it was that you began to run your own book and what that involved? Again, if you can't remember the date.
I can't remember dates or particular books as such, no, but I was still attached under someone. I think I was working under Terry Connor by now. But obviously it meant I had a little bit more independence and more responsibility. And it certainly kept you on your toes, because if you had the responsibility of the profit and loss of a certain book, you were aware that your remuneration, which was based on a salary and some sort of commission related to the profit of A, the firm overall, but B, your individual performance at the year end, it did give you a lot more to think about.
Did you have a particular attitude to jobbing or a particular technique? Or?
I must have done. I don't know. Well, one of the things about my dealing style, I think I hated to lose money. It might sound a silly thing to say, we all didn't like losing money, but my method of dealing, if you like, I would accumulate small profits, and they would gradually mount up over the weeks and months, rather than perhaps some of the more extrovert dealers who would take perhaps larger risks, make larger profits, but also make some large losses. And the net result at the end of the year may well be the same, or I may well be in front of them. Mm. But it was a bit perhaps of a lower profile, which is why I tended to specialise more in second-line companies that I was dealing in. Mm. And this remained with me over the years, really. I've always dealt in more second-line companies. Mm.
Did you feel you had to approach dealing in the second-line stocks differently to dealing in the leaders?
Yes, I think so. You had to know a little bit more about the companies, because the household names, the ICIs of this world, brokers dealing in those shares were unlikely to ask you particular questions, because it may well be common knowledge, or everyone knew what they did. But if you were dealing in stocks such as Wilkinson Mitchell or Bain and Hodge or companies of this nature, brokers who got these orders quite often didn't know what these companies did for a living, and they may well ask you about them, what they did, what the company was like, etc., their profits record, and you would be expected to know more about second line companies.
Mm. Were they very competitive markets? Were there many other jobbers dealing in?
Yes, they were competitive. Not so many market makers, of course, as now since Big Bang, but yes, they were competitive.
Did you have much contact with your competition during the course of the trading day?
Yes, you would occasionally, of course, challenge them as such. If you had a choice price or there was a funny price, a backwardation, you would then go across and talk to them. But there was not the contact that there has been developed over the last few years, no. Mm. You would tend to stand alone and get on with your own thing, yeah.
Did you ever have much, how did you find out what your competition was doing? I mean, how did you ever find out whether there was
a choice?
Well,
basically, you didn't. Oh, you'd only find out if it was a choice price or a backwardation if a broker told you. The etiquette, again, in those days, was that jobbers were not allowed to deal on a backwardation. Brokers were not allowed to deal with you if there was a backwardation. But, of course, he had to tell you. If you made 3.6 and someone else was making 7.5, 10.5, if you sold them at 6, he could buy them from you and go and sell them at 7.5. He's made a turn, he's got the backwardation. But if he didn't tell you, you may not know. He could deal with you on a choice price, But more often than not, if the broker was of good standing and you had a good rapport between the two of you, he may well give you a fraction more, so you were not dealing on choice. But that was perfect. That was entirely up to him. That was his decision. Mm.
Did you have particular brokers who would always come back to you to deal?
You developed relationships, yes, with various brokers over the years who would try to deal with you. Because obviously, if it's a two-way thing, you would tend to hope make them more of a commercial price, or you would try to do their business because you know that they're not necessarily going to be sort of particularly hot or harmful to you, whereas other people you're a bit shy of. And you knew who were particularly people who were friendly with other firms, so you know you would tend not to be too commercial to them.
I want to ask you now about a few of the practices that sprang up in the jobbing system as the nature of the market changed and the institutions became more important. Mm. Things like joint books and minimum spread agreements and so on. Did you, as a jobber or as a jobbing firm, have any experience of running a joint book with?
Yes, we had joint books, several joint books. In stocks with various other companies, particularly with Wed Durlacher in